This feature of the Science News Radio Network is coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas. Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And it's super great having you back again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. Today we're going to have as our guest Dr. Ari Perlinger. He is professor of the School of Criminology and Justice Studies. At one time was associate professor for Combating Terrorism Center at the Department of Social Sciences at West Point, and is an authority on the politics of the far right in Israel. Fascinating, because last week, Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel announced there's going to be 2,500 new Israeli homes built on Arab territory. And, of course, this brings into question about if there will ever be a two-state solution, and if there isn't, if there can ever be peace between the Palestinians, of course, and the Israelis. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers. We're going to visit our Fountain of Useless Information in the second half of the program. And at the end of the program, of course, the listener comments and the voice of reason. But right at the moment, I think what we need to do is probably get to the telephones here in just a minute and check in with Dr. Perlinger. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online anytime, webcast, at promiseoftomorrow.biz. All right, we're going to go to the phones right now, and we have a fascinating guest with a great background, Dr. Ari Perlinger. He's professor in the School of Criminology and Justice Studies at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, and prior to that, he was director of terrorism studies and associate professor at the Combating Terrorism Center, the Department of Social Sciences at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Welcome to the program, Ari.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
We're so glad to have you. Now, you're going to be presenting a paper at the IEEE International Conference on Homeland Security Technologies, which is going on April 25th through 26th. Those who want to know more about that can learn at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link, and it'll tell you all about it. But in the meantime, we're going to get kind of a preview. So, Ari, what's the title of your presentation?
So the title is Fighting Together, Understanding Bilateral Cooperation in the Realm of Counterterrorism.
Okay. You seem to have an extensive background in that, as I notice. You're studying, related to terrorism and political violence and politics in the far right in Israel. That's going to be fascinating. You're in Europe, in the U.S. Middle Eastern politics. So can you give us kind of a preview? What are some of the things you're going to want to be driving home at the conference?
So basically, I'll present a research that tries to answer a very simple question. Why sometimes state actors that are facing the same terrorist group or struggling with the same terrorist group, sometimes they prefer to cooperate and sometimes they prefer to fight alone? We all know that today most counterterrorism campaigns are being conducted in the form of coalition of multiple countries, multiple polities that are trying to push forward specific counterterrorism policies or specific military campaigns in order to defeat terrorist threats. And what we are trying to explain is what are the factors that facilitate such cooperation and what are the factors that sometimes really prevent a cooperation in the realm of counterterrorism.
So when we're talking about states collaborating, I presume that's what we're talking about, and not commercial industries, although maybe that too. But yes, we cooperate with Germany, and in some ways we want to cooperate with Russia and other places. But there's also, you suggest there are times when the cooperation is not something that's desired. Is it mutual distrust?
Well, there are several factors that explain the reasons that states prefer to cooperate or not. So some factors are related to the relationships between the targeted states. Do they have an existing alliance? Do they have a previous incidence of cooperation? So this is one factor that may impact the level of cooperation between two states. Another element is really the nature of the threat. How significant is the threat and how it is being perceived by both states? So there are some specific threats that may be perceived as significant by one state but marginal by the other states. In these kind of cases, there will be less incentives for cooperation. And finally, there's also factors that are related to the characteristics of the states. For example, we assume that states that have similar regime characteristics will be more inclined to cooperate. So democracies, for example, will find it easier to cooperate with each other. This is not the case when we're talking, for example, about democracies and authoritarian regimes that, you know, for many different reasons will find it more difficult to cooperate and share resources. So these are basically the three major factors that we felt may determine the level of cooperation between states when they need to fight a similar terrorist threat.
Well, when we talk about our allies, of course, our democracies, we're led to believe, are countries like France and Germany, and of course Israel, and then we would think that the non-democratic states would be like the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and some of the other ones. Am I tracking with you correctly there?
Yes, you're correct. Yes.
So then.
And also
Go ahead, please.
So we also differentiated between different types of cooperation. So we looked into kinetic cooperation, which includes, you know, joint military or similar operations, and we also looked into non-kinetic cooperation, which looks into diplomatic cooperation, intelligence sharing, etc. And we try to identify which factors facilitate kinetic cooperation and which factors facilitate and non-kinetic cooperation. And there's different elements that really facilitate these different types of cooperation.
Do you have an opinion over those countries where we seem to have a closer cooperation than our allies that we don't? Some of us are under the impression that we're supposed to have a close cooperation with Israel, and that is kind of here and there, and off and on sometimes, depending on who happens to be in office in the United States and who happens to be in office in Israel. But we also seem to feel that we have a close, very close cooperation with Paris and with Berlin. And of course with London and these other areas. Can you see various degrees? You obviously do see various degrees there. Can you kind of give us an insight on those degrees?
So there's definitely strong cooperation with our long-term established allies. We can talk about Israel, especially in the context of Middle Eastern terrorism, and we can talk also about many of the NATO countries when you're talking about the jihadi threat. There's an intensive intelligence sharing, there's sharing of resources, and also there's, of course, cooperation on the kinetic level in different arenas, whether it's in parts of Africa, whether it's in parts of the Middle East or South Asia. I think that most Western countries, I think, recognize that that jihadi groups are the most significant threat that we are now facing in the context of the terrorist threat, and they understand the importance of working together in order to mitigate this specific threat. But Israel also, you know, countries such as Israel and Saudi Arabia, for example, also have regional interests that sometimes can contradict American interests, for example, whether it's, in relation to the end results of the civil war in Syria, whether it's about Iran. And I think in the last few years we've seen these contradicting perceptions eventually also being manifested in the way these countries are dealing with their own specific threats. We've seen, for example, that Israel was willing to basically intervene in the civil war in Syria when it felt that its interests are being threatened. For example, when Hezbollah was trying to smuggle weapons from Syria to Lebanon, especially weapons of mass destruction, then Israel intervened and used its air force in order to prevent the smuggling of such military technology, despite the fact that, you know, both countries had an interest that Israel will not intervene in the conflict. So there, it's a very delicate balance between the need to address the interests of both countries, but also each country naturally has its own interest. And what we were able to identify indeed in our research is that, especially when we're talking about kinetic cooperation, the existence of alliance will increase the likelihood of cooperation, but also when the countries share common characteristics, whether these are similar regime characteristics, and when there's a strong sense that the terror threat is significant and almost existential, then we'll see more inclination towards cooperation.
Well, of course, NATO countries, there's quite a few of them. I mean, close to 30, I think. You know that more than I do. But and our cooperation with them wouldn't be comprehensive because some of them we can consider may leak vital information to maybe an opposition. I mean, for instance, the Ukraine or Estonia or Latvia or some of these countries. Do you see various firewalls there built up between the different countries so that we have various degrees of cooperation and know how to navigate all these things?
Definitely. Some people forget, for example, that in 2014, when Obama was trying to form some kind of an international coalition to fight ISIS, Turkey, for example, was objected this this initiative and initially basically declared that she won't participate in any such effort. Things changed since then, naturally. But definitely, I think each country is, as I mentioned before, is trying really to balance between its international commitments to its allies and its own personal or its own interests, which in many cases are being influenced by political internal political considerations, as well as regional consideration, and we've seen that also in the case of Iran. It is very clear that Iran is utilizing various proxies, terrorist proxies such as Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria, such as Shia militia groups in Iraq and also in some other countries, such as Yemen. And we can see that different countries in the region, as well as the U.S., have different ideas regarding how to approach this threat. And you know, and that naturally impacts eventually the level of cooperation and the objectives of the cooperation between the countries.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Turkey. Turkey is largely considered an Islamic state, and I would suppose that there was some pushback about an Islamic state warring with another Islamic faction, even if it happened to be ISIS. And, of course, that changed when there was a lot of terrorism in Turkey. And then Turkey's got its own problems with the Islamics, that are the Kurds, who are causing problems in one area and yet fighting ISIS in another. And that leads me then to another question. I mean, Donald Trump is saying that he's going to want to cooperate closely with Russia in fighting ISIS, but Russia is sort of aligned with Iran in fighting ISIS. And does that going to make that navigation incredibly difficult?
Well, without getting too much into the political discourse, and we really don't know eventually how things will materialize, I would just say that our findings show that the chances for a significant cooperation between the U.S. and Syria are fairly limited. I think there are significant gaps in terms of the political culture, in terms of the regime characteristics between the U.S. And Russia. I think that in many ways we're not facing similar threats, and also in terms of the willingness of the relevant bureaucracies in both countries to really to effectively cooperate. So while I'm hearing the idea and thoughts of the upcoming administration, I'm still skeptical how much such a cooperation can really materialize, considering what we find regarding the factors that can mitigate such cooperation. All our findings show that such a cooperation will be very, very difficult to push forward.
ISIS has claim to fame for a number of years was the acquisition of land and got a lot of it, but we're driving them back. They're losing more all the time, and some speculation is they're going to change from being land holders to going underground the way Al-Qaeda has done. Do you see that in the future for ISIS?
It's definitely a possibility, and I think that but one thing that we need to remember is that there is really very basic differences between ISIS and Al-Qaeda in terms of their vision of how the jihadi war should be handled and managed and executed. And I think that it may be that eventually ISIS will need to transform themselves into some kind of a global network that will operate in multiple countries, and by using local cells, this is definitely possible, and ISIS already created a significant network of affiliates in many different countries, especially in developing countries and in ungoverned areas. So this is a possibility, but I think one of the things that we need to understand is that the source of ISIS strength was by its ability really to provide resources that other organizations were not able to provide, such as a safe haven, such as the training camp, such as the material and the financial resources that they were able to gain via their control over territory. In many ways, the reason that Al-Qaeda became such a successful organization almost two decades ago was because of its ability to have because it had controlled territory in Afghanistan, which allowed it basically to host different organizations, to provide them material resources, to provide them training, to provide them financial resources. So territorial control is proving to be an important factor in explaining the success and the emergence of these kind of organizations. And we've seen that Al-Qaeda had difficulties to maintain its status within the jihadi world because they lost their territory. So ISIS may transform eventually into some kind of a decentralized global organization, but that means also that it will lose many of the advantages or many of the factors that allowed it to be such a successful entity.
There are those who feel that winning the jihadi conflict, let's call it that, instead of a jihadi war, but that won't happen because the jihadis is an ideology. It's a feeling. It has nothing at all to do with boundaries and states and that sort of thing. But that cells all over the world who embrace the jihadi idea will continue to disrupt things no matter what we do, and that the ideology of Al-Qaeda and ISIS can never be defeated. Are you of that opinion?
I'm not sure I agree. I think if you're looking first of all into the history of modern terrorism, we see that we had similar waves of ideological terrorism. You know, in the 60s and the 70s, we had hundreds of groups that promoted Marxist, Leninist, communist ideologies. You had really dozens, if not hundreds, of groups in Europe, in Latin America, in South Asia, even here in the United States. We had the Weather Underground and many other groups. So, and eventually this wave eventually declined and almost completely disappeared. And I think that, as you mentioned, I think our main, the main challenge is really ensuring that the jihadi ideology won't continue to expand, to try to prevent them from effectively disseminating their ideological principles and recruiting more followers. And this is something which is challenging, but I'm not thinking that this is something that is impossible to do. I'm not arguing that we'll be able to eliminate and to eradicate every cell of the jihadi movement, but I think it is possible really to bring it down to a manageable capacity. This, you know, it's not like left-wing organizations really disappeared. There's still left-wing organizations in different parts of the world, but this is a manageable threat. The same goes for far-right groups or other types of ideological groups that are using violence. And so I do think that this is something that it can be done. It won't be a short process, but I'm not sure. I think history tells us that, you know, these kind of ideological waves eventually tend to decline.
Well, it's heartening, I must say. And, of course, in reading over the sketch that you sent me, something caught my eye, which I find quite fascinating, politics of the far right in Israel. Israel has been a fascination to me ever since the 67 war, as a matter of fact, is when I first became very interested in what was going on in Israel, and finding the politics of the Middle East always seem so intractable, like there's no end to it. But a lot of people don't understand, I think, that really the interior of Israel is kind of at war with themselves. It's been said by the Israelis, so many Jews, if people would quit trying to fight the Jews, they would kill themselves off. How do you can you expand a little bit on what you're finding with the politics of the far right in Israel?
So basically, what I was trying to do is to try to identify the factors that facilitated far right violence in Israel. I did similar studies also on the American case, and I think one of the major differences in the Israeli case is that the Israeli far right is really a religious far right. If you're looking into all the far right groups in Israel that perpetrated a violent act, you'll see that the great majority of them, if not all of them, were basically driven by clearly a religious fundamentalist ideology. In many ways, basically, there's these militant activists truly believe that annexing the West Bank and ensuring Israel control of the West Bank is a part of some kind of a religious holy process or a redemption process that will end up eventually with the creation of a Jewish kingdom. And for them, giving up land, especially parts of the West Bank, is something which is unacceptable for them. It's something which is against God's will, and they are willing to do anything in their eyes, anything that is necessary in order to prevent that.
Really appreciate your insights, Dr. Perlinger. I think that it's impossible for us to understand, fully appreciate the fundamentalists in Israel and their relationship with their Arab neighbors until we understand that basic tenet of the religion so built in. We're speaking with Ari Perlinger. He's professor of the School of Criminology and Justice Studies at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. He's a speaker at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference going on the 25th and 26th. Of April. You can find out more about that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link to their website at the conference. We'll be back with more from Dr. Perlinger in the second half hour, so please stay with us. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online anytime, webcast, at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers, will we meet today?
Clint Murchison. Money is like manure. If you spread it around, it does a lot of good. But if you pile it up in one place, well, it stinks like hell.